is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist Jefferson Mason and marketing manager Nick Bartlett on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150-plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today. As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with two capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game.
I look at the traits, the intangibles. That's below the surface. Their body language, their work ethic, their coachability, just anything that I can pick out that I think makes them a better player, any of their traits that can enhance their talent. How are they in the locker room? How are they off the court? What kind of grades do they get? I try to peel back as many layers as I can to know more about the player and more about the person, because the character of a player and stop the talent from being good. So I don't neglect any of the on-court character traits or the off-court character traits.
Paul Biancardi is the ESPN National Recruiting Director for Boys High School Basketball. He's the lead analyst for all high school basketball games, which include the Summer of Next, the Geico ESPN High School Showcase Series, Dick's Nationals, the Jordan Brand Classic, the Nike Hoop Summit, and the McDonald's All-American Scrimmage. The former Horizon League Coach of the Year at Wright State University also serves as a college basketball analyst on the ESPN family of networks. Biancardi first joined ESPN in 2006 as a college and high school basketball analyst. He became ESPN's national recruiting director in 2008. He is a voting member of the McDonald's All-American Committee and the Gatorade and State National Player of the Year. Prior to joining ESPN, Biancardi was the head coach at Wright State University, where he was named the Horizon League Coach of the Year in 2004. He was an assistant coach at St. Louis in 2007 and 2008, Ohio State from 1999 to 2003, and Boston College from 1990 to 1997. While coaching the Eagles, the team reached the Elite Eight in 1994 and won the Big East Championship in 1997. Hoopscoop Online named him the number one assistant coach in the country in 2002, and he helped the Buckeyes make four NCAA tournament appearances, including reaching the 1999 Final Four. Biancardi is a 1985 graduate of Salem State, where he played for longtime NBA coach Tom Thibodeau and earned a degree in physical education. He played 4 years and was voted team captain as a senior. As a senior, he was also selected for the James Tuhaig Award for outstanding character, sportsmanship, and dedication. If you're enjoying the Hoopheads pod, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends in the coaching community about the show, and make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. Check out hoopheadspod.com, where you can listen to every episode we've ever recorded and find out more about the mission that drives our show. Take out your notebook right now so you don't miss any of the coaching nuggets shared by Paul Biancardi, the ESPN National Recruiting Director for Boys High School Basketball. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from ESPN, their National Recruiting Director for Boys High School Basketball, Paul Biancardi. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Mike, Jason, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are thrilled to have you on the show tonight. There's so much that we want to go through and talk about when it comes to your basketball journey, from as a player to a coach to what you're doing now with ESPN. Let's start with looking back when you were a kid. Talk a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger and what made you fall in love with it.
Well, I grew up in the city of Boston and, always went to the outdoor parks to shoot around. Basketball was really the last game I picked up. Growing up in Boston, it was football, baseball, it was hockey. And but once I picked up that basketball, it was later on in my middle school years, eighth grade, I really started to fall in love with the game. From that point on, I kind of dedicated myself to just basketball. I guess back then I was specializing myself and I didn't know it. But I got a chance to play in high school. I was a captain of the my high school, Pope John High School, small Catholic high school. And then I desperately wanted to go and play college basketball. That was the dream. That was the, you know, the only goal I had in life. And nobody recruited me. And my high school coach was nice enough to call some Division III school up in Maine. It was called Maine Farmington, to send me a letter to say that, you know, they heard about me. Well, that letter meant the world to me. And I had no idea where Maine Farmington was in Maine, but I was almost ready to go there. And I wanted to play Division I ball, which I know we'll talk about that a little later about ESPN and what I do. I was so, fixated on playing Division I. Well, I knew that wasn't going to happen. I was hoping and praying for Division II. That didn't come about. And I said, you know what, Division III ball is really good. But again, nobody recruited me, so I had to become a walk-on. So I basically invited myself, you know, to the party. So I'm going to Salem State College. It's in Salem, Massachusetts. I'm going as a walk-on. And my first year, I trial for the team. And I got cut. So life doesn't get any lower than that, guys, right? You're a cut walk-on.
So why Salem State?
Well, it back then, financially, it's all I could afford. It was part of the Massachusetts State College system, where they had about 8 to 10 state universities that were, you know, public colleges that were low cost, good education. They were mostly commuter schools. Some of them had, you know, dormitory situations. Salem State had dorms. So I commuted back and forth from Boston to Salem, which was a 45-minute commute. And I will tell you this. Back then, we couldn't afford a car, so I did commute. I had to take a bus 50 minutes each way to school every day. And I had to walk almost a half a mile to the bus stop. I say that because in today's generation, even with my own kids, you know, the bus comes right in front of the house. Yeah, to pick up the kids, and they still complain about riding on the bus. So try walking a half a mile, three quarters of a mile.
Was it up a hill in the snow with no shoes on?
It wasn't that bad, but I'll tell you what, there was a lot of snow between my house and that bus stop in the winters, and it was a good half a mile, three quarters of a mile, and it was public transportation, so you know you're waiting for the public transportation bus to come, and then on the way home it was really bad because on the way home you get dropped off and you had to walk a half a mile, three quarters of a mile in snow.
That's not a good way to end your day.
No, in Boston, the temperatures were frigid in the winter. So, but, you know, it was the only way to do it. So when you grow up in a way that there's only one way to do it, you do it. Either you do it or you do something else. And my love for the game was so strong. So my sophomore year, I tried out for the team, and I broke my ankle in tryouts. I'll never forget it. So now I'm at my third year, and, you know, I got my mother asking me, you know, what are you doing? You're going to get a job, right? I work some odd jobs, but all summer long, training, lifting, running, playing in two or three summer leagues, working out with friends, just obsessed to be part of something bigger than myself. And finally, in my third year, I made it. And then I finished my career at Salem State as the captain of the team, which was a big honor for somebody who was a cut walk-on years ago. And my senior year, I got a chance to play a little bit, meaningful minutes, not just the walk-on minutes. And I played for Tom Thibodeau, as you guys know, longtime NBA coach. So the experience was very fulfilling.
So you look back on that time, and obviously then you didn't know that Tom Thibodeau was going to become Tom Thibodeau. So talk a little bit about what it was like to play for him, what you remember about your experience with him, maybe something that you learned from him that eventually you took into your coaching career.
Yeah, Tibbs was awesome. I mean, he was only a few years older than me, because when I was a freshman, when I got cut, he was a senior on the team. He played at Salem State, and he may tell you he was good, but he was probably average to solid. He was a 6'2" power forward. And, it was awesome playing for him because I had such a love and a passion for the game. And even though I was in school and taking classes, you know, the only thing that was on my mind was college basketball, the games that you would watch on TV back then, or what you would read through the newspaper or Sports Illustrated or watch on ESPN. And then, you know, being with the guys on the team and learning more about the game. One of the things Tibbs really brought out in me was, I mean, I love the game. I could practice all day, and I was a very hard worker, and I wanted to learn more. And Tibbs had such a passion for the game. Like, you see it when you watch him coach the NBA games on the sidelines. Well, that's the way he was back in the 1980s. I mean, he was barking all the time from the moment you walked in the gym till the minute it was over. He would bark instructions. But, you know, I love the game. Well, he took that love and raised it. He showed me how much he loved the game, and you know that became contagious on our team. Now, he was hard to play for physically because he would go to all these coaching clinics, Hubie Brown, Mike Fratello, Bob Knight, Coach K, all the great coaches, and he would go to every clinic he could get his hands on. Well, then he came back, and he tried to be those guys. And, you know, he just implemented every single thing that he learned. And, you know, he was physically demanding to play for. Let's just say that on game day, we went an hour and a half and we taped them up.
Yeah, it's kind of funny just to hear, you know, you think about that. And even when he was in the NBA most recently, you know, the quote knock on him was that he was, you know, wore his guys out, that he was so physically demanding. And obviously, we all know now that there's so much more information available about, you think about the Kawhi Leonard load management type situations and just trying to get guys the physical barometers of where they are in terms of, you know, their fatigue level and trying to get them to their maximum performance. And yet, if you go back to, you know, that time in the 80s and 90s when, you know, those analytics, that stuff wasn't as available, I think it was much more prevalent to see coaches who practiced, you know, a full hour and a half on game day or had 3.5 hour practices. Whereas today, I don't think you see that as much on the college basketball landscape as you did back in the day when you were playing, or maybe when I was playing in the late 80s, early 90s.
No. And they have more information now about rest and recovery and, you know, wear and tear on your body down the line. Obviously, they didn't have that, those metrics. They didn't have that sports medicine intel back then. But, you know, you ask Jimmy Butler how, if Tibbs wore him out, I don't think he'd say that. I think he said he made Jimmy Butler a multimillionaire.
Yeah. Did you see that?
There's so many guys that swear. I think the guys that, in my opinion, and I don't know this, but I know some of them coming up through the ranks, the guys that complain about Tibbs and think he was too hard, in my mind, those are the guys that don't really love it and don't really have a great work ethic. Because you look at Derrick Rose, Jimmy Butler, they never complained. Those two guys loved the game, and those two guys were highly competitive, a lot like Tibbs. And some of the guys that Tibbs has coached, whether it's the Bulls or the Minnesota, you know, they might have been talented, but they may not have loved it like he does or as competitive as he is. And think about that Boston Celtics team in 2008 when he was Doc's right-hand man. Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, Paul Pierce, you know, Rondo, those guys love it, and they were highly competitive, and Tibbs was the defensive master of that group. So, but I'll tell you what helped me about him being so hard, that on game day, we did the shell drill live, and we would have to end practice, shoot around with taking a charge. So when we got back to the locker room after shoot around, the game was only 3.5 hours later. The guys that started and played all the minutes would look at me and say, I hope you're ready, man, because I am worn out right now. And I'm like, yeah, this is great for me. You guys are exhausted.
That's awesome.
So I'll have a chance to get some minutes and, you know, spot minute. And Tip says you can stay in there as long as you want, as long as you don't shoot it.
I love it. That's awesome. That is an awesome story. I want to ask you about something that you said a minute ago, and that was just talking about how in the summertime you were working out and playing with friends and trying to get yourself prepared after you got cut your freshman year, and you know, you talk about your love for the game. And I just want to get your take on playground basketball and just sort of how it's disappeared from, unfortunately, the American basketball culture to a large degree compared to what it was like certainly when you and I were kids. Can you talk a little bit about maybe your experiences with playground basketball and just sort of your general feeling about where pickup basketball is and just the impact maybe that you see in the greater basketball system?
Yeah, playing on the playground was the single most fun thing that I could do. I mean, I would do, you know, my mother knew that if she was going to get something out of me at the house, she would hold me away from the playground until I did my chores or my homework or whatever it is that I was supposed to do. She made sure I did those things before I went. So I wanted to go to the playground so bad that I would do homework and chores around the house. Because it was not a greater feeling than to show up to a playground, whether by yourself or with your friends, to play one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, or, you know, let's play five-on-five. And, you know, the idea of playing a game to 5, 7, 11, 21 in the hot summer evening when it would cool down, sometimes 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night when the lights would come on. And the best thing in the world is when you win, you stay on the court and the losers have to sit. And it was such a competitive environment because there was always new guys that wanted to come on. And you learned how to play against older, stronger, quicker, competitive guys. Or you played against guys your size and your age, but usually you played against guys that were, you know, at the playground that were older, tougher, and bigger. And that's how you learn how to play through physicality. You learn how to play as a team. You learn how to compete. And I think that was the greatest feeling because it was an awesome feeling about getting a 7 before that other team did. And you stay on the court and the other team has to sit. Yes. It's gone. It's gone in our society today for a lot of reasons. The game moved indoors. You know, back then in the late 80s, the play indoors was a luxury, right?
Absolutely.
You know, camps today, I run my own camps, and you, Mike, and I are part of the Jay Billis camp, and that's in a beautiful, air-conditioned Queens University in Charlotte. But the camps that I went to, and I know that Jay Billis went to, and yourself, they were outdoors, and they were 4 and 5 days long, 6 days long, overnight camps or commuter camps, and you didn't think twice about playing for 2 hours in the heat, having lunch, you know, and playing 2 hours from 3 to 5 in the afternoon. And so those days have disappeared from the outdoor game to the indoor game. And now everything is structured with some people call them showcases. I kind of call them repulsive basketball because it's really just set up. It's pay to play. It's kind of like what the NCAA has now going against them, right? Pay to play.
Right.
But the problem is the parents are paying and the kids are paying people to organize pickup games, guaranteed 2 games a day with officials in a very comfortable environment where I don't feel the competitiveness, nor do I feel or see the basketball IQ. Because you had to take good shots in your pickup game or your teammates would get on you and say, like, right. Why did you shoot that shot? We're 1 point away from game point. That's not what we do. And, you know, that's not how you win the game. And guys almost knew their roles on the playground because there was always somebody on the team that would put everybody in their place. That doesn't happen in showcases today or organized basketball indoors.
Yeah, I think
so. I think the kids have lost a competitive edge. And the last point I'll make is when our games were over back then in the outdoors, you would have a Gatorade or a bottle of water and you would bicker and argue with your teammates why you lost. Now, when a game's over, kids are going right to their phone and see what's going on in the world.
Right.
So yeah. it's a different mentality, and it's no fault of their own because that's when they were born. They were born in an age where all they know is technology.
Yeah. The other thing Mike's talked about too is a lot of times these guys are done playing a game, and then 2 hours later they have to play another game. So the effects of losing that game, they don't even seem to care because they're like, oh, we got to play another game in 2 hours. You know, like when it comes to the AAU
system. That's the competitiveness part of it I was talking about. They're guaranteed another game. When you play pickup basketball, you don't know when your next game was because you have to sit and there's maybe one or two teams on the sidelines waiting to get in. So you got to kind of fall in line. And there was a prideful feeling about, I guess, winning games and staying on the court. And here, like you said, Jason, it's, your next game is scheduled. You know when it's going to be. So there's not that urgency as there used to be, I think, on pickup basketball.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I've said it a bunch of times. I think that competitive piece of it is a huge part. And then I think the other thing that you touched on, which is basketball IQ, and I wanted to get your opinion on this. I think that, and I've said this a couple times in conversations with several coaches on the podcast, but I think that the kids today at the high school level, if you look at players 7 through 12 on a high school roster today, I think those kids are much more skilled. And by skilled, I mean they can dribble the ball better. They can shoot it better. If you put them on a court by themselves with some cones, they're going to grade out. They're going to look a lot better than maybe guys 7 through 12 in the era when you and I were playing. But if you look at the basketball IQ, I'm not sure that the basketball IQs of those same players are the same. And I think that has to do with, as you just laid out very, very well, with the demise of playground basketball and the rise of playing with only kids your own age, always playing with a referee, always playing with parents in the stands. And consequently, you never really develop the ability to think the game for yourself because there's always somebody there looking to tell you what to do. And I think that sometimes impacts players' basketball IQ, where they're not making those decisions on their own because they've been under the watchful eye of a coach or a parent from the time they're 6, 7 years old, whereas you or I played the vast majority of our basketball out on the playground with nobody watching us except our teammates who their motivation wasn't, you know, their motivation was to try to win games. And that was, you know, they wanted you to perform your role, as you said, to help them win so that you guys could keep playing.
No, you've knocked it out of the park when you say that, because, you know, the thing about the officials, I think back, we used to call our own fouls and we used to argue about the call. And sometimes it could get into maybe a physical pushing, borderline, maybe a fight. Maybe you have to shoot for it. You know, if you make the shot, then you get the call. Everything was so competitive outdoors because you had to fight, sometimes physically fight and just physically be, you know, the aggressor all the time to get what you wanted. And it made you tough-minded. It developed, I guess, a grit that you could bring with you to the high school game when you played, or if you had a chance to play in college. So I miss those days for the kids today, because I think it would do them a world of good. But you're absolutely right. They're more skilled. Their bodies are better sooner because there's more information and more equipment and more strength and conditioning coaches than ever before. So I think kids have a chance to be better athletes sooner, have a chance to be more skilled. But with those things comes, you know, the flip side. I think kids today are more robotic in games because of the heavy emphasis on skill trainers. Every kid wants to make a move or make a shot versus read the game, read the possession, and learn how to do. They don't want to learn how to do other things off the ball or without the ball in their hands, I should say. And it's an uphill battle to get most of them to play defense, which we know is, you know, guys make a living on playing defense and how important defense is. So there's specialization today, and that leads to good things, and it leads to some things that are not good for these kids. And so it's definitely a two-way street.
In your mind, what's the most positive thing about the system that we have today? If you had to point to the number one thing that you say, this system that we have today compared to the system of 30 years ago, it's better at doing what? What's that one thing you think we're better at doing from a youth basketball standpoint here in the United States today than we were 30 years ago?
Well, a couple of things. One thing is better. There is more grassroots basketball teams than ever before, whether they're part of the Amateur Athletic Union called the AAU, or they're just travel grassroots teams. You know, like the Nike circuit, Under Armour circuit, Adidas circuit. So there's more opportunities for kids to play than ever before. And I think that's awesome. And I do think that coaches know more about the game that are coaching that can help kids than ever before, because there's more information about the game, whether it's online or it's coaching clinics or USA Basketball coaching clinics, which I love what they're doing. I've been a part of a couple of their clinics where they're giving out licenses for kids to coach. And think about what we do at the Jay Billis Camp. We have the coaches development program. So when I was coming up to be a young coach, I had to learn from the person I worked for, and I had no access to really anyone else. You go to the Jay Billis Camp and you put yourself in the coaching development program, you get a chance to actually conduct drills or help conduct drills, work for a college head coach, a Division III coach, you know, be around lectures, be around drills, and actually help coach a team while you're learning more about coaching. I mean, to me, that blows me away. So there's so many more things today for the game, the players and the coaches than ever before. And I think that's a big, big positive. The question is, will they take that information and transform it, whether it's into their game or into their coaching career? That will they take the information and turn it into action is the question.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that the access to information today as a young coach or any coach, no matter what stage you are in your career, you know, you're one phone call, one email, one video, you know, one coaching clinic away from being able to be in touch with just about anybody. And I mean, our show is sort of proof of that we've been able to get and be connected to so many great people that have been so willing to share. And I think that's the other thing that is so great about the coaching fraternity and sorority, is just the willingness of people today to share what they know and try to improve the overall game of basketball. There's much less, and I don't even know if there was secrecy back then. It just was, we just weren't as open. We didn't have as much access, like you said. But nowadays, pretty much you ask somebody for, hey, what kind of things are you running, or how do you build your culture, or what do you do with, you know, player relationships? And people are like an open book. They're so willing to share. And I think that's something that, as you just said, just is such a great thing for the coaching profession, because it allows you to take from some of the people who are doing the best, most innovative things and pull out what's going to work for you and allow you to incorporate it into whatever it is that you do. And I think that's something that is invaluable for any coach who's out there in the profession.
Yes, I agree 100%. I really do. There's so many good things about the game today. I just think I would like to see the younger kids be more competitive, play with a little bit more urgency. There's so much for them to do today. When I grew up, or guys that grew up in the 80s, even the 90s, you know, you had television, and then you started to have a cell phone. But today the distractions are at an all-time high. There's how many apps kids can be on. There's social media sites, the Twitter, the Instagram, the Snapchat. Of course, we have the internet. So there's places for them to go that take them away from the game. And sometimes I think it takes away their interest in the game, or their, I don't want to say their love of the game, but maybe time away from the game, and they get interested in something else. And I think it pulls a lot of kids away from sports in general. But I think, you know, the coaches today can do a lot more to help the kids than ever before as well. So
yeah, I agree.
It's a great game going forward. And that's what I love about our Jay Billis camp. It's pure basketball 24/7 for 3 days.
Yeah, the camp, just for me to have an opportunity to go down there and be a part of it and just observe and see what was going on and get a chance to jump in occasionally. I've never been to a place where you have, A, the player-to-coach ratio is, you know, 50 coaches for 100 kids. First of all, that's just incredible. And then, you know, you alluded to it while you were talking a minute ago, the fact that if you're part of that coach's development program, when the kids go to lunch or they get their break, which is typically when, as a coach, if you're at a camp, you kind of get your break and go and sit in the cafeteria and talk with, not there. There you're bringing in, you know, whatever, great high-level speakers, athletic directors, Division I head coaches, people who are willing to share and come in. Some of the best are coming in to talk, and to be able to sit in that room with your fellow coaches and listen to people who have had tremendous success and have so much to share and are so willing to share. I just think it was such a unique environment. I walked out of there so energized about the game of basketball. Again, it's a credit to Jay and you and to John Searby and what, you know, Shulman and all the guys that have been sort of a part of it from the beginning, and what you've been able to put together.
Yeah, I think coaches have a chance to meet people. As I said, I used to want to meet college coaches so bad when I graduated from college. And the only way I could meet a college coach is if I worked a basketball camp all week long, and that coach who came in to give a lecture that day, he would come in for an hour, do his lecture, hang out a little bit, and then leave. I would make sure that I went up and introduced myself to him after, and I got 30 seconds with whatever coach came to that camp, and that's the only access. I didn't get the phone number, right? I could send a letter if I wanted to, but there was no way to connect with coaches of a higher level, pro coaches or college coaches. So it's fabulous, not just with Jay. The Jay's camp is like 5-star on steroids. That's what it is.
It really is.
It's the old 5-star camp, because it's pure about the game, but it also has a networking and a connection, a relationship, a part to it. And the first night there, we're all at Jay Billis's house. I mean, you know,
all these coaches, high school, college, and coaching development guys, they're over at Jay Billis's house, getting to know and meet Jay Billis and the people in the camp. Phenomenal.
Yeah, this doesn't happen. That doesn't happen anywhere else. I mean, it's just that blew me away, you know, having the opportunity to go. And then for me personally, that night I got to sit down, and we had already had Coach Showalter on the podcast, but that was the first time Coach and I had met in person. And I sat down and sat at the table and had a, you know, 45-minute conversation with Don Showalter. So how cool was that for me to be at Jay Billis's house and sitting down and talking to a guy who was a 42-year, you know, head coach at the high school level, and then all the 10 gold medals that he's won with the, you know, the national team. And it's just, it was unbelievable, just the whole experience. So if you think back, Paul, to when you were playing in college and when you were playing as a high school player, did you always know in the back of your mind that you wanted to stay involved in the game as a coach? Or was there another thought of, hey, I want to stay involved in the game? Or maybe you thought, I'm going to eventually go and get another job or do something. What? Tell me about how you came to the coaching profession and when you came to that realization that that's where you wanted to, that's where you wanted to be.
Well, once I picked up the ball when I was in, you know, the seventh or eighth grade, I said I kind of, as the last sport I played, so I really fell in love with the game. And once I got to high school and had a chance to play, you know, freshman, JV, and varsity, I would coach middle school kids. And that's when I really got hooked on coaching, because I was not only playing, and but I was coaching a middle school team of, back then it was called CYO, Catholic Youth Organization. It was 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. You practice, you know, once or twice a week, and you play on Saturdays. So that to me was just so much fun as a young player, getting a chance to kind of teach guys what you know and put an offense in and teach them how to play defense and kind of grow as somebody who, you know, you can call a timeout, tell people what to do, why to do it, and kind of show them how to do it, and bring a group of kids together and get them excited about the game. And then when I went to college, I coached high school kids, again, recreationally in Catholic youth organization. So but I knew in high school, guys, I knew that I wanted to not only play in college, but when I was done, I wanted to be a college coach. I want to be a Division I head coach someday. And that was the dream, and that was the desire and goal.
Was it the teaching piece of it, like teaching the game, that got you excited? Was it the relationship with your players? Was it all of it? Was there one piece of coaching that at that time when you were younger that really stood out to you?
I think it was showing them what I knew and then watching them pick it up, because they wanted to be good. And they listened to you, and they picked up what you showed them, whether it was a crossover dribble or a way to, you know, chase a guy off the screen, or how to block out, or how to run a set play. That really kind of turned me on as a not even a coach. I mean, I was a high school player, but that got me excited, and I loved the group of guys coming together, being competitive against another group of guys, you know, because I grew up very competitive. So I wanted those kids to be competitive too. And so I think that the motivational part for me, could I motivate them to love the game and want to win and be part of a group, and having them learn something that I could teach, whatever it may be back then. And I remember those were the first feelings I had when I coached.
Got it. So when you finished at Salem State, what's the first coaching job? You get out and you're going to go and teach school and be a coach. So talk a little bit about your first experience coaching.
Yeah, well, you know, everything I did in my life in college and post-college was for coaching. So, you know, you have to have a job, right, to pay your bills. So I got my teaching degree, and I looked for a teaching job out of Salem State College back then, which was considered a teacher's type of college. And when you don't get a teaching job, you have to be a substitute teacher. So I was a substitute teacher for years, at different school systems. But that allowed me to coach after school in whatever job that I had. And the first job I got out of Salem State was coaching JV High School. And I coached it with a guy by the name of Billy Killalay. And when you track and trace his roots, his father, John Killalay, was a longtime assistant to the Boston Celtics. So I thought I was connected to the Celtics back then.
Because, you're one step away from coaching Larry Bird.
Well, I tell you what, John Killalay coached, you know, the John Havlicek's, the JoJo White's, the Dave Cowens, and he was a premier assistant in the game and a very well-known coach. And, you know, he was an assistant coach to Bill Fitch, if you remember that name for a long time. And
Bill Fitch was here
in Cleveland, yeah.
I know him.
And other great Celtics coaches. So Billy was the varsity coach, and I was his JV coach, and I was the most excited guy I could imagine out of high school because I have my own team now. And then when that practice is over, I get to help Billy with the varsity. So every day I had to coach my team and help him, you know, be his assistant. So you're talking about 6 hours in the gym, and I didn't even know, you know, the time went by. And then you get home and you go to bed, you eat, watch some TV. You do your practice plan for the next day. You wake up, you go substitute teach somewhere, and then you drive to your practice. And so that was the first year of coaching. But what really helped me be a coach, guys, was going working camps. As we talked about the Billis camp, but I would work camps when I was in college. You know, I'd go as a player and then as an assistant coach. And then when I graduated from college, I would look to work camps. And you know, I'd travel anywhere in the East Coast I could get to in a car. Dave Cowens had a camp. I worked that camp for 10 years so I could be a head coach all week and then learn from Dave Cowens and the group that he had. I worked before it was the Hoop Group. There was a camp called Eastern Invitational out of New Jersey. You're talking about Five Star or any other local high school coach that had a camp. That's what I would do all summer, just work camps from, you know, Monday to Friday. And it wasn't for the money. It was for the experience of being a coach. So that's what I did in the summers. First job I got was JV. And then from there I got to the college level because I really wanted a recruit. I really thought that was an exciting part of the job, to, you know, pick players to come and play for your team. But I realized right away it wasn't that easy. You don't pick them, right? you've got to travel a lot. You've got to travel a lot. You got to get to know a lot of people, and you got to put a lot of time and energy into it. But I worked at a Division III school called Suffolk University with a wonderful mentor by the name of Jim Nelson. And then I went back to my alma mater at Salem State. I did that for a year with the guy by the name of Dana Skinner. It was a great player, and he had a cup of coffee with the Celtics. And then I got my big, big break. I became the volunteer assistant at Boston University. So I spent 5 years at the Division III level, 1 year JV, and I was trying to climb that ladder, and I didn't know how to move up. So I just volunteered my services to Mike Jarvis at Boston University and said, I will do anything and everything that you need for absolutely nothing. So he hired me.
How can you say no?
It was a good deal. I mean, as long as you did what you were supposed to,
Well, I'll never forget what he said. He brought me in at the end of the season and he said, "You did a fabulous job." And he says, "I want to double your pay." but actually what he did for me was I got no money, you know, nothing. But I got to be the gopher, the, you know, glorified graduate assistant, but I didn't have to go to school. I did everything and anything from go get his laundry to wash the van that we had to help on scouting reports, to help in drills, sit at the end of the bench and monitor the bench. Whatever role he gave me back then, I had a chance to learn from him and Billy Herrien, who was just a fabulous teacher of the game. Billy's now the head coach at New Hampshire. So I had a lot, you know, Carl Hobbs was on the staff. Carl Hobbs, as we know, head coach at GW, played at Connecticut. He's now at Rutgers, I believe. And Andy Greer was on the staff. Andy's been a longtime NBA assistant for over 20 years. In fact, he worked with Tibbs in Minnesota. So I was surrounded by basketball, you know, genius, and I didn't really know it at the time, but I felt it. And so Mike gave me a trip to the Final Four and a ticket, and that was my reward for being the volunteer. And that was my very, I think it was my first Final Four in 1989. And from there, I got the graduate assistant at Boston College. I kind of did the same thing. I threw myself at the head coach and said, you know, I'll take whatever position you have. And there was a graduate position open, graduate assistant. So I became the graduate assistant at Boston College. I was 28 years old at the time. Broke, in debt, didn't care a bit. I was in the Big East, and I just thought I died and went to basketball heaven.
All right, so when you went from Division III to Division I, was there anything different about sort of the roles of the coaches, things that went on at the Division I program that maybe just weren't possible at the Division III level? Is there anything that you remember in terms of the adjustment or just the way you kind of approached, you know, being on a part of the coaching staff at the Division III level versus the Division I level?
Well, at Division III, you don't have, you know, four assistants and a manager and a volunteer and all those things. You Division III, you have a head coach and maybe two assistants. And for us, it was, I think it was one and a half. I was the top assistant, if you want to call me that, you know, fresh and green in the coaching profession. But that gave me an opportunity to do so much. And again, Jim Nelson was a tremendous mentor. He was the AD and the head coach at Suffolk University and won a lot of games, and he was brilliant. But he gave me a lot to do, which made me a better coach. The budgets are different, so, you know, the amount of things that you can do are different. But the way the game was coached, the way you scouted, and the way you recruited was the same, was just at a higher level.
I think there's some universal truths about the game of basketball, and that's kind of what you're talking about here. Is if you're when you're teaching it, again, everybody has different philosophies on how you go about approaching the X's and O's of your team and that kind of thing. But regardless of that, there's some non-negotiables that it doesn't matter if you're coaching a fourth grade team or you're coaching a Division I basketball team. There are just certain things that, as a coach, that you're going to demand. If you're going to have a winning program, there are things that you have to make sure that you're doing. So when you get that graduate assistant job, and as you said, you're broke, you're in debt, but you're living your dream. What at that point, what were you thinking in terms of sort of your career path, or were you not really even looking that far ahead? Were you just excited about where you were in the moment, and you weren't really kind of plotting out your future? Or just give me a little insight of your mindset at that point when you got that GA job.
The mindset that I had, and I tell kids today, and I tell coaches this today. In fact, when I spoke to the coaches development program, you know, I have a lot of phrases today and a lot of, I guess, experience. And one of the phrases I use is, you know, big time is where you are, not where you want to be. It's a way of telling kids and coaches, you have to treat where you are like it's the most important place in the world, or you're not going to become better at what you do. And you're not going to get a chance to get to that big time because you're going to cut corners or you're going to daydream about somewhere else instead of doing the job that you have. So when I was the JV coach at Stoneham High or Division III assistant, I mean, you talked about universal things in the game. When I lost the game, or we lost the game, or if I lost a recruit at Suffolk University, it hurt just as much as losing a recruit at Division I. If you lose a game, you're upset and you're pissed. If you win a game on the road, you're elated. Didn't matter if it was Division III or Division I. All the feelings and all the preparation and all the teachings are the same. But I always tried to take where I was and give it all I had. But one thing I did do is when I had free time, which wasn't much, I would always go to other people's practices. We do that today now. A lot of coaches do that to learn. Well, I just did it instinctively. You know, when I was at Division III, I did go to Boston University's practices. And in fact, Rick Pitino was the head coach back then.
and I go to Northeastern practices, and I go to Boston College practices, and I go to Holy Cross practices, and I went to other schools. So I got to meet the coaches. Again, to me, it was meeting the coaches was great, but watching the drills, because drills were so big back then, and watching schemes and offenses and defenses, it was so exciting. In fact, I think it was Gary Williams, you know, was the head coach there at one time at Boston College. I used to go to his practices too. So you got Gary Williams down one end, you got Rick Pitino down another end, you got George Blaney, the longtime coach at Holy Cross, and he was an assistant for Calhoun for a while. So I think that helped me a lot. That helped me meet other coaches, and it also helped me be better as a coach while I was coaching a particular team. And I would encourage any coach that's listening to go to other people's practices as much as you can if the schedule allows it, because not only do you meet people in your profession and get a bond that way, but boy, you can really pick up something and learn a lot. It's like getting a 3-credit course in 3 hours.
Yeah, I think you mentioned something that I always often thought about more when I was playing, but you talked about earlier about how when in the era when you first started coaching, that basically you could learn from the person that you were coaching with, versus now we can learn from just about anybody through all the easy ways we have to connect through the internet and everything else. And so I always used to think when I was playing that it would have been fun to be able to go back and go and see somebody else's practice just to see how, okay, here's how we do it at Kent State, but let's see what an Ohio University practice looks like, or let's see what, you know, a practice at the University of Michigan looks like. And that was something that as a player, I would have always found fascinating just to go and see, because you're so isolated in your own little world. And I think sometimes, you know, obviously as a player, you're like that, but back in that era, I think oftentimes as coaches, it's easy to sometimes you get so wrapped up in your own situation that maybe by going out and observing, like you just described, different practices, how different coaches do things, you're going to pick up, whether it's drills, whether it's X's and O's stuff, whether it's just little ways of handling, you know, different things that may arise in the course of a practice, that's going to make you a better coach. So my question for you, just related to what you were saying, is when you would go to these practices, did you have a formal way of keeping track or note-taking, or how did you go about putting down the things that you learned? How did you collect those things so that you could then apply them to either your coaching situation now, or I'm assuming you were also kind of putting things away and filing it away if you were to ever get an opportunity to have your own program?
Yeah, I took a notebook with me everywhere and just wrote down the drills, how the drills were conducted, what was the, you know, the instruction, what were the points of emphasis, how could I bring this, bring this back to the team I'm help coaching. How can I give it to my head coach? And you just keep a notebook of drills or plays, out of bounds plays, presses, and concepts back then. You know, I was just writing down every single word and I was drawing as many diagrams as I could. And it was just to increase my knowledge. So if in a game I saw an opponent do something that I learned maybe at a practice, I could maybe help my head coach with better suggestions. And today now in my ESPN job, you know, back then you always thought about, well, let me go to a higher level program, watch them practice because, you know, they must know more. I mean, that was my thought back then. And sometimes that's true and sometimes that's not. I've watched some high school coaches that have been, you know, fabulous over the years. And I know Division III coaches that I've met at the Billis camp and guys that I've done clinics with, and how they're such good teachers of the game, and, you know, how they understand discipline and accountability and how they run their program. So for all the coaches listening, it doesn't always have to be a program that's higher up. It could be a program that's right next door to you, or, you know, right at your level, or a high school coach. I watch eighth grade coaches and I see some of the things they do and how they teach maybe the simple basic fundamentals, and I'm like, that's really good. I should be showing those type of things to, you know, kids in my camp, or if I have a coach again, you know, maybe I'll teach it this way instead of the way I do it. So there's so many people to learn from in so many places.
Yeah, there sure is. It's amazing what's out there. We talked to Craig Campbell, who coaches at Clovis West High School out in California, and he talked about how he had shifted his program around teaching his kids the hop and just how it had made a complete transformation. He says he gets college coaches on the women's side to come down and watch his practices and, you know, borrow his drills and just come in and watch what they're doing. And, you know, here you have, you know, he's got Division I, he's a high school coach, and he has Division I college coaches coming in to watch his practices. Because, again, you can find great things, as you just said, you can find great things everywhere in the game. There's always people who are doing good things. And as you said, you have, it might be at a different level, and it might be for a simple fundamental that maybe you might not use directly with your team, but maybe, as you said, you do it at a youth camp, or there's all different ways of approaching it. I just think it's what makes the coaching profession so great today, is just the willingness of people to be able to share with others. And so, speaking of that, you spent quite a bit of time in your career as an assistant coach. So if you were to give any coaches who are listening out there advice about what it means to be a good assistant, what should they do, or what are some things, some tips you would have for somebody who's an assistant coach? How can they be the best possible assistant they can be to help their head coach and to help their overall program be successful?
Well, you know, again, where I started was like the bottom of the bottom. So being a volunteer, being the GA, and then getting promoted. So I've done every conceivable job as an assistant. I would tell anybody who's an assistant at any level, do as much as you can for the program and do as much as you can for the head coach. And when time permits, do as much self-improvement as you can. That may come in the off season more so than during the season. But a willingness and a want to do more for your program. You know, some people say, well, that's not my job, or, you know, I'm not going to do that. It's paperwork, or it's compliance work, or it's, you know, I say sweeping the court. I mean, I used to go in with a broom and mop the court before practice because our coach didn't want anybody to slip on a wet spot or, you know, dust. So I said, well, if I sweep the court, and I know that the custodian may or may not sweep it at Division III, you don't know.
Right.
So you go in and you check with the equipment manager and you say, hey, you need any help with the laundry? There was no job that I thought about was beneath me at any time. So when I became a full-time assistant, I knew how important every little job was, every little responsibility of the program. You can stretch yourself out to a point where, you know, you do too much. But I just think if you just try to help the head coach serve him and make his life easier, take things off his plate, and the more you do on your own, the better assistant you can be, and ask him if there's more that you can do. That not only prepares you to be a great assistant, but it prepares you to be a head coach someday. And I was very fortunate. All my head coaches, you know, gave me, I asked for more things and they kept giving me more things. And, you know, you learn how to scout an opponent. You learn more about recruiting. You learn about home, you know, how to conduct a home visit. There was one point in my career that, you know, I asked the head coach, I said, hey, you know what? I know you don't want to go here, but I really like this kid. I want to do a home visit by myself. And, you know, that doesn't happen very often that assistants do home visits.
Right, right.
But I would go in there and talk to a recruit and his parents. And, you know, it was just a phenomenal experience to do things like that, you know, hosting official visits. So you try to do as much as you can to be as good as you can and to make your head coach as successful as he can be. Because the truth is when the program wins, the players will benefit, and the assistant coaches and the head, everybody does benefit. And that's kind of the golden rule. So that's the first thing I would say. And the second thing I would say to any assistant coaches, you know, don't be a know-it-all. Don't be somebody who comes in with all the answers and doesn't have any questions. Because nobody wants to work with somebody who thinks they know it all. And there isn't anybody out there, including head coaches, that know everything. You know, the great head coaches I always say this, the great head coaches surround themselves with great assistants, not yes men, and not people who are just going to do, you know, whatever the head coach says. Had a chance to work for Rick Majerus. You know, he hired two former head coaches, myself and Porter Moser, because he wanted guys that were going to not challenge him, but, you know, make sure that he was doing maybe the right thing, or if somebody had a new idea. And he would always say, tell me what you would do different and why you would do it. And that made him better, and it made me, you know, a better assistant. So surround yourself as a head – when you're a head coach, surround yourself with great assistants. But to be that head coach someday, you have to think, act, and feel the responsibility of a head coach. I'll tell you one thing I did all the time in my later years as an assistant. We would have our game plan, and we would have our checklist of plays and end-of-game situations. You know, you kind of have your little playlist and your game plan. When I would drive into the game, I would always think about what would I do if we were down 10 with 4 minutes to go? What would I do? What would my suggestion be to the head coach? If our best player fouls out with 2 minutes to go, who would we want in tonight's game? Who would be the first guy? Like, I would try to make decisions on the way to the game. So if they came up during the game, at least I rehearsed it in my mind. I tried to play the game, the what-if game, before the game. So if it happened, at least I can have a good suggestion for the head coach. As crazy as that sounds, that's the way I prepared for the game.
Yeah, that doesn't sound crazy at all. It sounds, I think, like somebody who really cared about what they were doing and somebody who wanted to put the time in to help their team be successful. And, you know, nowadays, I think that visualization piece, you know, it's obviously players, you know, we usually think of visualization more with players and thinking about, you know, you ask your players to think about situations, or if this arose, what would you do here? Or, you know, we're about to do this. How would you handle that? But I think from a coaching standpoint, I think that's a great, great tip that you just gave to people. If you can really kind of work through and think about different scenarios of, hey, how would I handle this or how would I handle that? I think anytime you can be more prepared going into it, the more likely it is that you're going to make a sound decision in the moment. Because if you have never thought about that and then you get into a pressure situation, we all know that under pressure sometimes we tend to lock up a little bit more, and maybe we don't always consider all the possibilities and we have to make that decision on the fly. Maybe we don't always make the best decision, but we've taken the time beforehand, like you did, to think about that. Man, that's got to be just a huge advantage in terms of thinking about, hey, what are we going to do in this situation? And now when it does happen, or maybe something not exactly like that happens, but something similar, now I've already gone through that scenario in my head and I can be more calm and cool and collected and ended up hopefully making a better decision as, you know, when that situation actually arises.
It really helps you as an assistant coach, because when something happens in a game, your head coach may ask you for a suggestion. You don't really have time to think about it.
Right.
To play the what-if game, you know, what if we're down 20, you know, what if this play doesn't work? What if this offense is struggling? What if we're turning it over? How would we change the lineup? You know, just over and over scenarios. So I almost went into the game as if I was going to coach the game, and I thought that made me a better assistant coach for my head coach.
All right, so let's move from you being an assistant coach to you being a head coach. Talk about how your opportunity to get the Wright State job came about, and then talk a little bit about how you went about attacking that and building the type of program and culture that you wanted to do in your first year.
Well, I got the job, obviously, from the success that we had at Ohio State. I really didn't know much about Wright State. In fact, it wasn't a job that I kind of dreamed about. You know, when I was at Boston College, I wanted to be the head coach at Boston University or Northeastern or Holy Cross. Those were like dream jobs for me. And none of those opportunities happened. But after some good success at Ohio State and also the Boston College success of Elite Eights and Big East Championships and the Big Ten tournaments and Final Fours, I had a chance to get the dream
of being a Division I head coach. And I quickly realized that in the state of Ohio, it was, I believe, 16 to 18 colleges, universities, basketball.
Yep.
And you know, kids didn't grow up dreaming about going to Wright State. I found that out quickly. It was Buckeyes first, and then everybody else second. But you know, recruiting was much harder because you know I'm not looking at the best of the best. Now I have to find guys that fit that, you know, that mid-major role that you know, can help us win. So like any job, you go into a job because the person before you, obviously, it didn't finish as strong as they would like, but obviously the person before me did a great job because he had success at one time. And in fact, Ed Schilling was the coach before I was, and he beat Michigan State one time being the head coach at Wright State. He did some unbelievable things. And then time expires like it does for a lot of us. And so went in there. We had a really good first year. We won 10 games in the conference, which is really good. There's 9 teams in the conference. We won 10 games. That was the most that Wright State ever won in league play. And that led us to a 500 season overall. We were picked for last. We came in third. And things were good. And the next 2 years were kind of 500. For the next 2 years, the overall record, you know, was 500. In my career there, but the way I attacked the job was, you know, I was so ready for it based on all the experience I had at Division III, Boston University, Boston College, and Ohio State. And I see guys get jobs today really young and quick. I don't mind guys getting jobs at all. I think it's really great. But sometimes when you've only been an assistant, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, and that's a tough seat to take. Every decision falls on your lap. Everything you do gets second guessed. Think about it. When you're the assistant, you make one suggestion or maybe two. When you're the head coach, you get second guessed maybe once or twice.
Right.
And everything is reflective of what you say and what you do and how you run your program, what uniforms you buy, you know, how you change the locker room, you know, the things that matter to winning and the things that don't matter to winning, who you recruit, how you discipline. It's a very consuming job, but I will say for the, I think it was 16 years, it was 14 years at the Division I level and then 20 years, 18 years overall as a college assistant, it really prepared me for that moment. So I think guys that have a chance to win and also to rebuild is important. I think if you just won for 5 years and you go take a college job, you know, you're not going to just win that quickly and that easily. So I think it's good that you learn how to bounce back from losing, losing season, losing streaks, winning big games. How do you respond after a big win or a great season? So I was really prepared for the job. And as I say, I was prepared for it. There were some learning curves that, you know, you still had to learn how to handle.
What was your biggest challenge or challenges as you stepped in from going from a longtime assistant to being the head coach? What do you remember of being things that proved to be challenging or that you thought were going to be challenging when you went into them?
Yeah, I think it was that, and most coaches will say it, the coaching part of it wasn't, I really enjoyed that. Practice and scouting for opponents. The pure basketball stuff, I was very comfortable with, and I was comfortable recruiting. I just had to have a different eye in recruiting. I had to learn how to recruit a guy that I had really a chance to get. But it was the off court. It was the administrative stuff. It was the day to day operations of the program that you have to oversee. I think that's so time consuming. You know, the academic monitoring. When you're an assistant coach, you're responsible for 2 or 3 players, and that's it. You know, the head coach, you're responsible for the whole team, study hall. You can delegate, which I did, but you still have to confirm a lot of things. And I think that was the hardest part. It was such a consuming job. If you were to do it right, there were so many parts that you had to make sure yourself that it worked.
Do you think, and I'm speaking now, I guess, maybe to all levels of basketball, but one of the things that I think is most challenging for coaches today, and I see it, I guess, more from the high school level, just because I'm more familiar with that level in terms of my own personal relationships with different coaches, but it just seems like that work-life balance, so to speak, and just the amount of time that it takes for you to run the type of program that's going to be successful, seems to me that that's a huge challenge facing the coaching profession today. Because if you really want to be successful, and I don't care, again, if you're a high school coach, a college coach, whatever, the amount of time that you have to put into it in order to be successful, I think the baseline amount of time that has to go into it is much higher, especially on the high school level today, than it was, again, 15 or 20 years ago.
No, that's a great point. And I think that's what I was trying to say. I didn't know how to budget my time. I mean, yeah, I was only 40 years old or 42, you know. But I remember, honestly, guys, I remember falling asleep in the clothes that I was wearing coming home from work with the cell phone right in my hand. I mean, that last call I had to make to California, you know, where it was 3 hours difference, or the West Coast, or the last film I had to watch, I, TV's on, you know, my wife would come in, and, you know, it's like 1 a.m, the clothes you had on from when you came home from work, you're sitting there watching a tape that, you know, ended hours ago. So it's really consuming, and to budget your time is really hard. That's why I said before, hire great assistants who are diligent, knowledgeable, loyal, and all have a specialty to some degree. Because the one thing I did was I hired guys that I really trusted and believed in. And good assistant coaches can take things off your plate so you can have some time for yourself. And your point is so well taken. Today you can learn how to balance yourself a little bit better. I was totally out of balance. My kids were young, and, you know, obviously I saw them, but not as much as I wanted to see them. Now, I was a very present father, but I was physically present. I can tell you the times that they would tell me stuff, and I was thinking about, you know, how we're going to defend, you know, Bruce Pearl at Milwaukee or Butler's, you know, ball screen action. My kids would be telling me one thing, and I'd be thinking about something else. So
we've all been there.
Yeah, the Horizon League was a killer back then with Pearl and Milwaukee, and Butler was Sweet 16 good, and Milwaukee and Chicago. It was a great conference. But, yeah, so it's consuming. Didn't know how to budget my time. All I knew was do more. And I think today you can get that information, just like the kids. They get information on how to be better players. There's so much information on how you can be a better husband, a better father, and a better coach. And if I had to do it all over again, which, you know, that day may come, you know, the balance is just as important as the work ethic.
Yeah, it
really is. You got to have a strong work ethic, but you have to have a strong discipline to have balance, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. I think discipline's a great word to choose, because it's easy to get caught up in how important it is to be doing X, Y, and Z. And, you know, we've all been there at points where you end up, maybe neglecting is the wrong word, but just as you said, you may be there in body, but you may not be there in spirit with, you know, the people that you love and that you spend the majority of your time with. And that can certainly be tough. All right, let's transition from coaching to what you're doing now. So talk a little about, A, first of all, how you got to ESPN, and then what it is that exactly you're doing for people out there who may not understand exactly what you're doing day to day.
Well, I was with Rick Majerus. You guys know that name. Legendary coach at Utah, took the job at St. Louis. And so I'm working with him, and a position opened up at ESPN to lead and direct their recruiting. They started on the football side, and then they got into basketball. Well, one of my college teammates, younger than me, was a sophomore, and we became really close and friendly, and we've stayed that way for the last 30 years.
he happened to live next door to the person that was looking to hire the person for the ESPN recruiting position. They wanted somebody who's been a head coach. They wanted someone, if not a high major assistant, somebody who could really eyeball these kids, rank them, evaluate them, grade them, and tell the country who the best players are, why they're so good, what they need to be better at. And then when they make a decision to a certain school, you know, react to it. How does the fit go? And all the things that I did my whole life, but I never did it in a public platform. So they called me about the job, gave them some names of coaches that I thought would be good. They came back to me. It was one of those situations where the more I said no, better the contract kept getting. So
nice negotiating, Paul. I like it.
It really was, and it wasn't meant to be that way. It was meant that I'm happy, Coach Majerus. You know, everything was great at St. Louis. I mean, I was working for a legend and a brilliant basketball mind who, you know, could be combustible at times, but he treated me very well and my family, and I was learning so much. So when the offer came, it really was such a good offer that gave it a second look, realized that I could always go back being an assistant if that didn't work out, and really just kind of gave it a chance and tried something new, and told my girls, my daughters, that, you know, we're going to go do this, and unless something great happens, we're going to stay in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's where we moved, and we'll see where this thing goes and how it grows, and boy, did it grow. I mean, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. When I say bigger, I mean, you know, ESPN putting on high school games, the dot-com covering it. Social media has given life to recruiting. And plus, I get to do a couple of dozen college games every year, which is phenomenal because that feeds the itch, you know, that I have and the passion for the college game. It's been such a blessing of a job. That when I first took it, I said, well, maybe this isn't for me. I want to go back and be with a team and coach a team. But then I realized I'm coaching the country. You know, when you're an analyst and you're a recruiter, I get to go to all the major events. I get to see the best players in the country. I get to interview them, get to know them, see why they play well, what makes them tick, what makes them, fail. So I had a chance to learn from different college coaches by going college games, going to practices, and the thing is, when you work for the media guys, everybody gives you access, right? You know, you don't have any more enemies,
right?
So the job has been an absolute blessing. I've learned so much about the game. Even though I'm not coaching a team, I feel like I'm coaching every day, and I've learned to evaluate talent so much better than I did when I was actually coaching, recruiting, and evaluating talent. I thought I was a good, you know, every recruiter will think they're a good evaluator, and they should think that. But when you do something every single day for 12 years, and you put a lot of effort and energy into it, and you, you know, you care about it, you become good at it. So I really have become much better in the evaluation game. I've learned so much about recruiting because I've got so close and so connected to the players, and at the same time, I've stayed close and connected to the coaches. So I understand that communication, that gap, that bridge. And of course, the X's and O's, the strategy, the drills, the friendships. It's been wonderful. It's been an absolute blessing of a job, and developed a whole new friendship of people at ESPN and in the media industry. And I picked up skills that never thought I had or never thought I'd need.
Hey, you got to be in front of the camera guy, so you get to develop those skills for sure. And, you know, as you said, when you can focus on one singular task, you can't help but get better and improve. So along those lines, when you're evaluating players and when you're looking at them, what are some of the key things that you look at as you're trying to put together and rank a player? What are the things that are important to you as you're trying to project who the top recruits in the country are? What are some of the things that you look for specifically that allows you to put together your rankings?
Well, I first look at the player's performance. And when I do that, I look at their, I have to look at their makeup, right? I look at their athleticism. And inside of their athleticism, I look at their explosiveness, the ability to get off the ground quickly and multiple times. I look at speed. I look at wingspan. I look at standing reach, height, positional size, strength, power. And can that body, does that body have an upside in the game? And then I go to the skill level. You know, everything there is to do with skill. The ability to pass the ball, to see the floor, to make layups, to make jump shots, to make mid-range shots, to shoot off the dribble, to shoot off the catch, the transition game, the skill of the game, the flow of the game. And then I look at things that have nothing to do with skill, the rebounding, the defense, how do they contribute without scoring? And when going back to skill for a second, you know, the ability to handle the ball. Is a guy a one-dribble guy, a two-dribble guy, or can he handle pressure and create space for himself? Is he comfortable handling the ball, or does he just want to put the ball on the floor and get rid of it? I look at basketball IQ. How do they read the floor? How do they read their teammates? How do they understand the defense? And conversely, defensively, do they understand, you know, help, recover, close out? Do they understand when there's a trap, where to rotate after? So anything and everything with basketball IQ. And then I look at the traits, the intangibles. You know, that's below the surface. Their body language, their work ethic, their coachability. Just anything that I can pick out that I think makes them a better player. Any of their traits that can enhance their talent. How are they, you know, in the locker room? How are they, you know, off the court? What kind of grades do they get? I try to peel back as many layers as I can to know more about the player and more about the person because, the character of a player can stop the talent from being good. So I don't neglect any of the on-court character traits or the off-court character.
Is there a guy that over the course of the time that you've been doing this that was sort of under the radar that maybe wasn't on the national scene that you spotted and thought, man, this guy is really going to blow up soon, or this guy's really going to have a better career than people think? Is there a guy or two that kind of fit that bill that you could share with us?
Well, one of the guys that I really loved, two guys, I loved a lot of guys, two guys that really impressed me in different ways. One was Buddy Hield. When Buddy was in high school, he came from the Bahamas. He was a highly graded player. I graded him as a high major minus, which means, you know, I didn't think he'd be recruited or offered or go to the upper echelon of the power conferences. Or be a main guy of one of those programs. But he did that. He went to Oklahoma, and they're obviously a upper echelon program for the most part. They have their down years. But Lon Kruger was really doing well. And Buddy went there for 4 years, and he went from a guy who wasn't a top 100 ranked player to a lottery pick. I think he was in the back of the lottery at 14 or 15, 4 years later. His work ethic, though, something that just really impressed me. Every time you would see him, whether it was a practice or an event, he was a great teammate, which I think is so important about being a good player. You know, I look for five-star teammates, not just five-star players.
Right.
And his work ethic was great, his tenacity, his resiliency. And then he kept adding to his game. The jump shot kept getting better. It was more consistent. It was deeper. He could shoot it off the catch, off the dribble. He enhanced his ball handling skills. He rebounded, you know, better every year. So he was a guy that just impressed me from high school to college, that transition, you know, the draft pick and now in the NBA. A guy who really has made it big in the NBA, who I loved in high school. But when you look at his talent, you say, you know, he shouldn't be where he is. But when you look at his intangibles and his defense, you know why he's there, is Marcus Smart with the Boston Celtics. You know, top 10 player in the class because he was physically stronger than everyone else. He was just an absolute lockup defender and a guy who scored the ball just with his physicality and some skill. But his skill level was not great in high school. His defense and his intangibles were off the charts. So his rise in the NBA, not surprising to me, but great lesson for a lot of kids out there.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for sharing those two guys. I want to give you a chance. We're getting close to an hour and a half, but I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about some of the things that you're doing. See, you're the same way as me. We look up at the clock. We're like, holy cow, that time went super fast.
We got to go to bed.
Yeah, exactly. Let me give you one more player, Mike. All right.
I coached at the ABCD camp. I coached Isaiah Thomas. I never thought he'd even be the last pick in the NBA draft on talent, but he had more intangibles and a winning spirit like I've never seen before. He was a talented player, and I had no idea, and I don't think anybody else did, that he'd be the NBA player that he is. But I'm not surprised based on his will and willingness to be great.
Yeah, there's a great lesson there in that, you know, work ethic and intangibles and just putting the time in and being a great teammate. If you do those things as a player, you know, that can overcome maybe some shortcomings that you have in other areas. And those are things that you can control as a player. I think that's super, you know, that's super important to remember. You can't control, you know, how tall you're going to be. You can't control, you know, to a certain degree, your athleticism. But certainly everybody can control what kind of teammate they are and how hard they work and what kind of attitude they bring. And there's nothing better. There's nothing better than that. Just talk a little bit real quick about your ebook, your camps, your training. Just give us the quick synopsis of some of those things so people have an idea of what you're doing with all that.
Well, I started a website, coachbancardi.com. I'm running camps. I'm doing private coaching. I wrote a book on recruiting. I watch game tape evaluation. I'm trying to help as many kids that want the help, whether it's through a camp situation, a private coaching situation, or just read a book on recruiting or get some feedback and some instruction on their game tape. So I do that in and around the job that's all year round, but it's just more basketball work. And obviously I love to work camps like the Jay Billis camp and other camps. And so I just want to be involved in basketball 24/7, 365, just like you guys.
Absolutely. There's nothing better than being involved in the game that we all love. And that it's been just it's a pleasure to be able to have an opportunity to talk to you. Before we go, I want to give you a chance. Just share how people can reach out to you if they want to get in contact with you. And then if there's any other point that we didn't hit on in our hour and a half, if you want to leave one more party shop, and then we'll come back and wrap up the episode.
No, people can reach out if they want. I think it's a good follow on Twitter for your basketball recruiting advice. I do every Monday with Rick Majerus. I bring up something that Coach Majerus taught me. I'm taking stuff from today's coaches and putting them on Twitter at Paul Biancardi, and obviously recruiting information, recruiting announcements, and same thing on Instagram. It's at Paul Biancardi. So that's where you can find me. You can reach me through email at coachbiancardi.com. There's a place to reach out to me, whether it's a camp, an apparent, game tape evaluation, for any service that you need or want.
That's awesome, Paul. Anybody out there, highly recommend, if any of the things that Paul just talked about strike a chord with you, make sure you reach out to him. He's going to be a tremendous resource. Paul, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure to have this conversation, dig into your journey, and just learn from all the great experiences that you've had in the game of basketball. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. we have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoop Heads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.